The title of this session this morning is Creation, Degeneration and Regeneration. Most of this winter school is going to be focusing on the last part, the regeneration. But if there is a regeneration, it has to be a generating of something which has degenerated. And if something is degenerated, it must have come from somewhere it's been generated at the beginning. So we're going back to the beginning with generation, and then we'll be spending quite a bit of time on the degeneration and pointing ahead to the regeneration about which we speak even more later on in the weekend. And I'd like us just in our minds, if not in our Bibles, to turn right back to the very beginning of the Old Testament and the opening words of that testament, in the beginning, God. And then in the beginning, God created. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, one Old Testament theologian says that sentence, and therefore the whole of the opening chapters of Genesis, can be summarized by three words: Creator creates creation. Creator creates creation. Now that to us sounds straightforward, and it is, but the order of those words is really significant because there's a subject and an object, and are joined by a transitive verb. God the Father, or God in his triune being, perhaps even better, creates. And he creates an object, creation. But as soon as you have creator creates creation with a transitive verb in the middle, you have what Brueggemann calls a one-way sentence. That sentence only goes one way. And that, to us, might not seem particularly significant, except that in the history of the world, and in the history of the ancient world in particular, to have a one-way sentence about creation ruled out a whole lot of things. And it rules in a whole lot of things. To have a one-way sentence about creation rules out, for example, any thought of pantheism. That is, this whole creation is God, and he can be worshipped at any point through any element of this creation because it is all God. No, creator creates creation. Makes a distinction between God and all other things, and an absolute distinction. It rules out idolatry. That is, worshipping anything in the creation as a god. Because creator creates creation. Therefore, any other element of the creation, or any element of the creation, is not worthy of worship. And should not be worshipped, because the creator alone is the one whom we should worship. And it rules out also an understanding which might place God on the side of a whole lot of other spiritual things. Sometimes we find ourselves perhaps even caught out in our own thinking unintentionally. We could think of the spiritual realm, and we think, well, in the spiritual realm you've got God and angels and demons and living creatures and elders, you know, the 24 elders in heaven and all of that. That's all the spiritual realm. And then you've got the material realm, which is us sitting here and desks and chairs and trees. No, there's only God and everything else. He's not part of the spiritual realm. He is the one who has made all things, including the angels and the living creatures and the 24 elders. So you've got God the creator and everything else. Creator creates creation, rules out everything that was common in the ancient world and everything that is common to our normal fallen human thinking. And then it rules in a whole lot of other stuff. As soon as you hear creator creates creation as a one-way sentence, it means he's sovereign. Now, we sometimes struggle, or people sometimes struggle, do they not, with questions. Could Jesus have performed a miracle? Is it possible that there are such things as miracles? Well, if creator creates creation, then anything that flows from the creator is sovereign over that creation. So the creator can command the sea to be still, and it is still. It also means that creator creates creation with a purpose. God doesn't create creation in order to see what will happen next. Let's poke something with a stick, see what happens, and get some entertainment out of it. Creator creates creation in order to bring that creation to a purpose. And we've read that purpose in Ephesians chapter 1, that all would be to the praise of his glory, or to the praise of the glory of his grace. You may think, well, that's a very egocentric purpose, a very unworthy thought, because that's the way we would think about ourselves if we were doing something for our glory. But when God does something for his glory, the creation is glorified. When we do something for our glory, it's at the expense of someone else. So when all things are for his glory, or all things are for the glory of his grace, it means that we, who are the receiving end of the glory of that grace, are glorified, and he is glorified as we are glorified. And it also means, therefore, that that creator, who is the sovereign king of the creation and has created the creation for a purpose, therefore rules and superintends purposefully, providentially, carefully over every element of the creation, so that that purpose will be fulfilled. Even the actions of evil men and women, even the actions of demonic forces, are not ruled out of that sovereignty. It does not mean that he is the author of their evil, but it does mean that he and the one who works even through the evil, you meant it for evil, God meant it for good. We know that statement so well. At least that it's there. Sometimes we struggle when we're on the receiving end of some evil and we cannot see any good in it. But that's another story. So creator creates creation, rules out a number of things and rules in a number of things. But in relationship to us as human beings, the story in creation, particularly in Genesis 1, tells us something remarkable about ourselves. That is that the creator who creates creation creates people in his own image. So the creator has in the center of the creation, or perhaps at the pinnacle of the creation, those who bear his likeness. Let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea. Male and female he created them and called them man. So that means that you can never understand a human being simply by looking at a human being. Nor can you understand a human being by looking at a human being in relationship to the other elements of the creation. You could only ever understand a human being by relating the human being to the one who's created the human being in his image. Does that make sense? So one Dutch Reformed theologian, Burkow, says there is no such thing as man simply. There is always man in relation. Man in relation to his creator. And even at the point in the Old Testament where that relationship is one of rebellion and exchanging the worship of God for the idols and so forth, the only way you can understand that as you read the Old Testament is here is humanity in relationship to God who says and does something about that. Even in our rebellion, you cannot understand us apart from who we are in relationship to God, who's our creator. So if we were to ask, what does it mean then for us to be the image and likeness of God? The answers will have been many and varied through the history of the church. Sometimes we can think about the vice-regency of God, you know. That is, the vice-regency of man under God. Let us make man in his image, in our image, let them rule. So there's a dominion function. Male and female he made them. So there's something about the relationship that expresses the image. So all sorts of ways in which the image has been understood over the years, and not any one of them is wholly right, nor is any one of them wholly wrong. Just turn with me to Genesis. Can't be far out, can you? Genesis chapter 5. Genesis chapter 5, beginning at verse 1. This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. So we recognize that language from Genesis 1, verse 26 and following. He created them male and female. He blessed them and named them man in the day when they were created. When Adam had lived 130 years, he became a father of a son in his likeness according to his image and called him Seth. Now do you notice there is a parallel between verse 3 and verse 1 and into verse 2? That Seth is the son of Adam. So the image and likeness language has something to do with fatherhood and sonship. So for us to be made in the image and likeness of God means that we have been made to have God as our father, just as Seth had Adam as his father. And indeed Luke takes that up in his gospel in chapter 3. You can look at it in that great genealogy at the end. He traces all the way back. So-and-so was the son of so-and-so. Seth, the son of Adam, the son of God. So whatever else the terms image and likeness may mean, one thing that they must include, and perhaps above all else, is the fact that we have been made to be the children of God, sons of the Father. And in that sonship, we have affinity with him as family. Now you may remember there's a remarkable statement about Jesus' identity in Colossians chapter 1, verse 15. It says, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. And so when he comes into the world, he comes as the Son. And as the Son become flesh, he becomes incarnate, and his name is Jesus of Nazareth. So in his humanity he lives out his sonship. And that is possible because originally God created man in his own image to have that affinity. F.F. Bruce, in his commentary on that passage, I think it's F.F. Bruce, says this: he, God, made man in his image so that he, God, might become man. In other words, there's nothing incongruous, nothing jarring about the eternal Son of God becoming a man, because he, who in all eternity, who has been the image and likeness of God, his Father, could express that image and likeness of God, his Father, in his incarnate humanity as a man. Does that make sense? It wasn't a hard thing for him to do that. Indeed, we could put it this way, that humanity is the perfect vehicle for expressing divinity. Don't know if you've ever thought along those lines. Humanity is the perfect vehicle for expressing divinity. Does not mean that a human being is divine. As a friend of ours said many years ago, he is divine. We are the branches. Now, it does not mean that you in yourself or I of myself ever share in the substance of the deity of the Father, Son and Spirit. But humanity, being made in the image, is designed to be the perfect vehicle for expressing that divinity in all its fullness. That's why in the end of Ephesians chapter 1 it can say the fullness of him who fills all in all through the church. Now this gives us a big hope to which we are called, doesn't it? Born again to a living hope that all of the fullness of God's divinity would be expressed through your humanity for all eternity. It's not bad. Hebrews chapter 2 verse 11 says this: For he who sanctifies, that is he who makes holy, and those who are sanctified, all have... Now there you have a translational problem. Some translations all have one origin. Some say they come from one stock. Some say they come from one source. Some sidestep the problem and say, come from one. And some provide what I think is the best word: he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified come from one Father. And the reason I think that's the best word is because of what he goes on to say immediately after that in Hebrews 2:11. For this reason he's not ashamed to call them brothers. In other words, it's a family term. Now, you are not, I'm sorry to disappoint you and disillusion you in any of this, you are not the eternal Son of God. You have not been generated from the Father in all eternity as his divine Son. You come from the dust, and we return to the dust, do we not? We are men of dust, but also men of glory. Because the eternal Son comes from the same Father who has created us in his image, in his likeness, to be his sons. And therefore the affinity that we have with the Son in creation is, if I could put it perhaps rather loosely, a perfect match. Nothing missing, nothing jarring, nothing out of place. There is a perfect match. So he comes from the Father, and we come from the Father. Yes, in different ways, but we come from the Father. And he stands with us in his humanity, and he said, these people are indeed my brothers. Now, for me, as I was saying to someone just a day or so ago, this verse the Lord seems to impress on my mind from time to time as being one of enormous comfort. That the eternal Son of God should not be ashamed to call me or call us his brothers. Isn't that just a remarkable thought? That the eternal Son should come and stand with us, and as we'll see, stand with us in all our degeneration, and say, I am not ashamed to call this man my brother. So not ashamed am I that I will actually bear all of his shame in my body on the tree, so not ashamed am I of him as my brother, that I will let all of the shame that attaches to him attach to me, because I am not ashamed to call him my brother in the midst of all of his sin and degradation and failure, and I will present him holy and spotless before my Father, and we will be one family. It's mercy, isn't it? Astounding mercy. Now the reason for saying all of this is to say it's very easy for us to think about creation in philosophical terms. How did God create? How long did it take him to create? By what means did he create? Is the doctrine of creation compatible with other understandings of human beings? And so on and so on and so on. But if we just think in those terms, we'll then come up with sort of theories about creation. The Bible's not really interested in theories about the creation. The Bible is interested in the fact that we have come from God. And that's why the title of this study starts with generation. It is creation. In the beginning, God. And he brings forth the heavens and the earth. And then he creates and forms man out of the dust of the ground. It is creation, but it's a relational generation, if I could put it that way. It's not a sort of philosophical or metaphysical exercise of God's power where he just sort of snaps the fingers and things happen. So we have been generated by the Father through the Son in the power of the Holy Spirit to live in affinity with him, so that all of the divinity can be seen in our humanity, and the whole of the creation could be brought to glory through that humanity, and in that, therefore, that the whole of the triune God would be glorified. So he's created us in his image according to his likeness. And he's placed us over the creation. And you will have perhaps be aware of the fact that the name Adam comes from a word Adama, which means the earth or the red dirt. Adam comes from the Adama, so we're the man of dust. But that does mean that there is an inseparable relationship between Adam and the Adama. What Adam does affects the Adama. What we do affects the whole of the creation. And we'll come to that later in this weekend, but you could see it perhaps most simply and clearly. Does the action of the second Adam, Jesus Christ, affect the whole of the creation? Yes. Does it transform, finally, the whole of the creation to bring about a new heaven and a new earth? Yes. So the action of the Adam affects the Adama. And our action as Adam affected the Adama. The whole heaven and earth is now under the bondage of futility because of the sin of humanity. But it's been subjected to that, let us never forget, in hope. So there is a generation which takes place, but there is also a degeneration. And there are two things I want to say under this heading. The first is simply this. Death is not merely an event. It is a state. Death is not merely an event. It's a state. I'll say more about that in a minute. The second thing is this. None of us, not any one of us here, not anyone in the whole creation, none of us can understand what sin is. We think we can understand it. We think we feel its effects. We think we know something about what our sin really is. But it could only be one who is absolutely holy who could understand what sin absolutely is. And one of the corollaries of that, therefore, is that we have no way of telling, no way of penetrating what Jesus suffered on the cross. Because we have no way of knowing the horror of human sin, because we are not the Holy One of God. So there are two things under this generation or degeneration heading that are important. Sin leads us to a state of death, not just an event, but to a state. And in that state, we have no true, full, proper, right understanding of what we have become and how degenerated that state is. Firstly, sin is a state. God said, "The day that you eat of it, you shall die." So did they die the day they ate of it? And the answer would have to be yes. They may have remained physically alive, but death as a physical event is an outcome of a state of existence. Now you get this in many places in the New Testament. You think, for example, of Jesus' words in John chapter 5. He says, "The hour, an hour is coming, and now is, when those who are dead hear the voice of the Son of God and live." In other words, he's saying, I'm moving amongst men and women who are in a state of death, and as I move amongst them, the word I speak is actually able to bring life to the dead. Then in Matthew chapter 8, verse 22, he speaks that word to those who are burying someone, do you remember? And he says, "Let the dead bury their dead, but you follow me." The people who are doing the burying are as dead as the man who's being buried, but the people who are doing the burying are still physically alive. And in John's Gospel, you see the raising of Lazarus as a sign of that. Lazarus, who is physically dead, comes into the tomb, or goes into the tomb, and Jesus comes to that tomb and speaks to a dead man and says, "Lazarus, come forth." It is no exaggeration to say that if any one of us hear the word of Jesus Christ, that word is heard in the ears of dead people. That's why in Romans, in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 19, the passage which Geraldine read for us, our change of state is a resurrection according to the power which was at work within him when he raised Jesus from the dead. It is that same power that has had to come to be at work in us to raise us from the dead. Paul says in Romans 8, verse 2, that we lived under the law of sin and death. That was our existence. We're told in 1 John chapter 3, are we not, that by this we know those who are the children of God and children of the devil. And that's John Dunkley's next study. But he says, these are they who have passed out of death into life. In other words, the realm of existence in which we lived, was in fact death. And we had to pass out of that into life. You remember the parable of the prodigal son, which Doug will talk about later this weekend. This son of mine was dead. You were dead in your transgressions and the uncircumcision of your flesh. Now, what's at the heart of that deadness? It's not a metaphysical concept we're speaking about, a philosophical proposition. If we've been created in the image of God to be his sons and daughters, the heart of the deadness is that we have refused that affinity for which we've been generated from the heart of the Father, and we have exchanged his fatherhood for another fatherhood. John's going to speak in the next study about the children of God and the children of the devil. You are of your father, the devil, says Jesus. And Paul doesn't sit back and say, well, that's just for those naughty people who opposed Jesus and crucified him. We also were foolish, disobedient, deceived, enslaved. We were children of wrath, even as the rest, sons of the spirit of disobedience. So when we talk about the degeneration, we're talking about total relational destruction, where we in our sin have not simply transgressed a commandment, but we have exchanged our fatherhood. We have walked out of the Father's house and sought another Father because we've not liked the Father we've been given. And in that total relational destruction, through our flesh, the new Father works his image, just as the Heavenly Father works the image in us of his Son. But when we see all of the terrible chaos that comes about through sin, what Jesus says in John chapter 8 is, well, you are doing the works of your father. I'm doing the works of my Father, you're doing the works of your Father. Whose image are you bearing? He says, in effect, you are bearing the image of your father, the devil, who's been a liar and a murderer from the beginning, who has come to steal and to kill and to destroy. And so various places in the scriptures we are told that that relational destruction has affected every element of the heart of man. Genesis chapter 6. The Lord saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, that every intention and the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And then after the flood, speaking of Noah and his remnant, and the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said, I'll never curse again the ground because of man, for or but or still the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Jeremiah 17:9 says simply, the heart of man is desperate, is deceitful above all things. The heart is deceitful above all things. Is desperately what? Some translations have sick, some translations have wicked, closely related terms. Who can understand it is the question. Mind set on the flesh, says Paul in Romans 8:7, is hostile to God. Hostile to God. Hostile to God. We in our sin are not disinterested in God, we actually hate him. We really hate him. It does not submit to the law of God. Indeed, it cannot. Let's turn with me to Mark's Gospel, chapter 7. This, of course, is a passage that's well known to us, I'm sure. But Jesus has been speaking to them in parables, and they're not quite sure what some of them mean. Verse 17 of Mark 7, when he had left the crowd, entered into the house, the disciples questioned him about the parable. He said to them, are you so lacking in understanding also? Do you not understand that whatever goes into the man from outside cannot defile him, because it does not go into his heart, but into his stomach, and is eliminated? He thus declared all foods clean. So he was saying to them, that which proceeds out of man, that is what defiles the man. For from within, out of the hearts of men, proceeds evil thoughts, fornication, theft, murder, adultery, deeds of coveting, wickedness, as well as deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these things proceed from within and defile the man. Sometimes said rather jokingly, let's get a data projector like this and plug it into your brain and view for public projection all the stuff that's gone through there in the last 24 hours. What's proceeding from the heart? It's from within. Out of the heart of man proceeds all of these things. There is none who is righteous, no, not one. Altogether they have turned aside, become wicked, corrupt. Their throat is like an open grave. The poison of asps is under their lips. Now, is there any exception to that rule? And the only exception to that is Jesus Christ, the second Adam, whose heart is totally aligned with that of his Father, and so from his heart proceeds love, joy, peace, patience, goodness, kindness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things there is no law. But we can't look at this list in Romans, in Mark chapter 7, and say, well, yeah, I really understand how that could apply to other people, but I'm sort of a bit further along the road. I'm not quite as wicked in my heart this week as I was last week. I've got a little bit less sin that has needed to be dealt with, as it were, on the cross. Now, there's a totality of human wickedness that had to be faced and met in Jesus' crucifixion that covers the totality of humanity. Now, part of the problem with this is
Well, the second part of what I was saying, we have no idea that this is the way it is. We compare ourselves among ourselves, and this is the problem that Jesus was addressing. Because our outward behaviours may seem relatively ordered compared to other persons' chaotic lives, because outwardly we may perform all of the duties and religious functions required of us, according to our understanding of that, by the law, and we do it without complaint, and we even go the extra mile, and we pay twice the tithes, and we do three times the fastings, and therefore we can look at that outward behaviour of ourselves and other people, and we can compare ourselves among ourselves, and we can say, well, I am not in the same position that that person is. And Jesus says, look, the issue is never one just of the periphery of your personality. The issue is what's in the heart. And in our hearts, beloved, we hate God. In our hearts, of ourselves, left to ourselves, we are children of wrath, even as the rest, sons of disobedience. Left to ourselves, of ourselves, we crucify the Son of God. And so when he comes to us in all of his goodness, righteousness, holiness and love, what you see in response to that is not the response of certain people who lived in an historical situation, and we would never do that. What you see in their response is the response of the human heart, expressed at a particular point through Caiaphas and Pilate and all the others. But the heart that expresses that is no different from the hearts with which you and I are born naturally, because we are born into a state of deadness where there is total relational destruction between us and God from our point. God does not stop relating to us in love and grace. This cannot come through except by the Spirit convicting us of sin, righteousness and judgment. The way in which some of this was expressed in some of the old theologians was through what they called the doctrine of depravity. And that stands for a number of things. It means, for example, that in that state of deadness, we are not able not to sin. You can't wake up one day and say, well, I'll just say goodbye to that old sin thing and now I'll be righteous. As I said of Spurgeon one day coming down from the pulpit or some place, and someone said, oh, Mr. Spurgeon, I just want you to know I haven't sinned for these last 6 weeks. To which he replied, you must be very proud of that, madam. She said, oh, yes, I am. We are not able not to sin. The doctrine of depravity, as it was formulated, said that it affects every part of humanity. That is, your mind is affected by it. You cannot reason as you ought. Your conscience is affected by it because it's not aligned to God truly. It's aligned to law and self-justification. Spirit, heart, mind, emotion, will, even we could say at the genetic cellular level, everything is affected by that sin. It does not mean, that doctrine, that every man or woman does every act of evil that is potentially open to them. But it does mean that every man and woman is capable of every act of evil. And if we were to say to ourselves, oh, I would never be in the situation where I would murder or thieve or commit adultery or bear false witness, then we haven't even begun to understand what Jeremiah said. The human heart is deceitful above all else. Jesus did not entrust himself to them because he knew what was in the heart of man. You can't trust yourself, you can't trust your brother, you can't trust your neighbour. You can only trust the Son of God because he alone is the faithful and true witness. So we stand in him, or we don't stand at all. So we have, as we said earlier, not a clue what the Lord has to deal with when he comes to us who have hated him in our sin, but have convinced ourselves that we actually are righteous and have loved him very much. And we don't have a clue what he had to deal with on the cross, where at that point he was made sin. And we don't have a clue what the holy conscience of the Son of God experienced at that point. The heart of man is deceitful above all else. Who can understand it? The one place, if I could put it this way perhaps, the one place in the whole universe where it was most clearly understood was under the judgment. My God, my God. And as we heard one of our speakers at summer school say, in a dream you think that you're just sort of skipping through the fields with the flowers and butterflies tossing up as you go. No, that's not what the Son of God has to deal with when he comes among us. But the remarkable thing in the face of that degeneration is that there is a regeneration. And that's why that regeneration about which we're going to be speaking so much this weekend, is a miracle and a work of grace. This is not a slight overhaul. It's not something that's slightly out of balance and we just need to tweak it a little bit to get it more stable. Like we're 80% there and we just need 20% of grace to help us because we can't make the last hurdle. This has to be a total reconstruction. There has to be a new heart and a new spirit put within us. And the only way that new heart and new spirit can be put within us is by the heart of man being taken out of the way. And the only way that can happen is through a crucifixion, because the whole of that old Adamic humanity has to be judged in its wickedness. And that's why when Jesus, as we'll come to see tonight, is speaking to Nicodemus and saying to him, you must be born again, he cannot make that statement without at the same time saying, yes, and there will be a serpent lifted up. I will be the one lifted up, just as Moses lifted up a serpent in the wilderness. Because if God could deal with our degeneration without the cross, then Christ will have died in vain. Can you see? But that regeneration, because what the last Adam does affects the whole Adamah, the whole earth, the whole world. All of the red dust throughout the world is affected by what the Adam does. And he says there will be a regeneration, a new world, when the Son of Man will come and those who will follow me will sit on their thrones, judging the tribes of Israel. We will be a kingdom of priests, in other words, as Martin was speaking about last night. Behold, he says in Isaiah, I create a new heavens and a new earth. The former things shall not be remembered or called to mind. There are other passages in Isaiah which make similar statements. We don't have time this morning to follow them. But every one of those passages that promise the new heavens and the new earth is through the veil of judgment. I'm going to bring about a new heavens and a new earth because I'm going to judge the idolatry and the sin and the wickedness of my people. So when the cross comes to us, or when Christ goes to that cross, it secures the promise. Peter says, according to the promise, or his promise, we are waiting for a new heavens and a new earth in which only righteousness dwells. And that's the reading from Ephesians to which we come back where we finish. That at the end there will be that transformation when all things will be filled with the fullness of the Son of God through his church. That's the regeneration in its final goal to which we've been born. Magnificent picture, isn't it? I'm going to sing.